What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, please consider us as a, if you don't mind, a primary resource to get those questions answered. Now, today, we are not taking your phone calls because we're doing a special mailbag edition of our program. The mailbag's getting just a little bit heavy. Our producer, Pedro, is tired of lugging this thing from studio to studio. So he says, why don't we do a mailbag and lighten my load a little bit? Well, we're glad to do that. So today it is Pedro, our producer, me, Tom Price, and Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you getting along?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
I think you're going to get a kick out of this first email that we're going to do from Robert. You'll love this.
Let's hear it.
Especially the wording of it. So is God some sort of factory of souls that creates and sends one when a baby is conceived? Or did he create a huge limited stack in the beginning? And what does the Catholic Church believe about this?
Oh, that's a lovely question.
Isn't that great?
I love that. All right. And, you know, it puts me in mind, I don't know if you saw this, one of the more recent Pixar films called Soul.
Yes.
You know, I mean, terrible metaphysics, horrible cosmology, but great story.
Oh,
you
sure.
Know? And if you like jazz piano, which I do. You know,
which
it's all about a jazz pianist. This is wonderful. And, of course, the background of the story is this view of the soul as this manufactured entity that then gets dropped into a physical body, you know. And that view has been around for a long time. A lot of pagan religions and philosophies have held that point of view. So, you know, Plato famously believed in metempsychosis, which is the preexistence and the immortality of the soul. And there were some sort of divergent Christian figures in antiquity, in particular Origen of Alexandria, who was censured for this belief, by the way. The church rejected this, but he had the belief that God sort of pre-created souls and then, you know, dropped them into bodies, and that, you know, salvation for him was getting out of the body and back to God. But that was incorrect. You know, the church ruled that out.
Mm-hmm.
But that idea has existed before. But it's not the Christian idea. It's not the biblical idea. It's certainly not the Catholic idea. And there may be a confusion not only about the origin of the soul, but there may even be a confusion about the nature of the soul in your question, right? Because you seem to be conceiving of the soul as a kind of concrete entity that exists as one kind of stuff over against the body that exists as another kind of stuff, and the union of the two might involve something like a kind of Cartesian dualism in your mind. And that really is not the way the church thinks of or defines the soul. Now, what Catholic philosophers have finally settled on in thinking about this question, they've more or less adopted the Aristotelian view, which is another philosophical perspective, but the church says, yeah, that actually works. That sort of describes the reality. And so I got to give you the Aristotelian terms to make sense of this. For Aristotle, as for all ancient philosophers, at one level, the word soul just means, well, whatever it is that makes a living thing to be alive rather than dead. So if you see a live dog and you see a dog that's roadkill on the side of the road, or maybe the same dog, Rover runs out into the road, he's alive, he gets hit by a car, he's dead. Materially, there doesn't seem to be anything different between them, right? They still have the same, you know, number of cells, basically, right? The same parts are still in existence. So what's different about them that causes one to be alive and one to be dead? Well, whatever the answer to that question is,
yeah,
and we have some intuitions about what that is, but whatever the answer to that question is, that's just what ancient philosophers meant by the word soul. So when you hear soul, a lot of times you import the idea, you already have the sort of the pre-existent idea of the ectoplasm or the ghost in the machine or whatever, and get all that out of your head. Just understand soul, for lack of anything other term, just means whatever it is that makes a living thing to be alive.
Okay.
Now, what Aristotle thought the answer to that question was, what is it that causes a living thing to be alive rather than dead, just inert matter, was that the inert matter was arranged with a certain kind of organizational functional structure that was that in virtue of which the animation took place, right? And so there's a kind of formal arrangement of parts. And he used the word form to describe that. All right. Now, don't confuse form with shape. Right? Form is not the shape. Form is really the intelligible aspect of a substance that constitutes it as the kind of thing that it is. That's what form means. And so for Aristotle, what causes living things to be alive is that formal structure. There's a kind of structural functional organization to the parts that creates that organismic harmony that we call life. And the church said, yeah, that actually works. We accept that. And we also note this, that part of the organizational functional structure of the human being, part of the operation that is human life, is rationality, which means freedom of the will, moral responsibility, the capacity to conceptualize universals that have infinite scope. In other words, there's something about the human person that participates in immateriality, even though it takes place within a material medium. And so the human soul, we define like Aristotle, it's the form of the body, but there's something immaterial about that form. Now, once you understand that the relationship of soul to body in Catholic thought is the same as the relationship of form to matter, then you understand that that conceiving of them as two radically separate things, that you know one could exist before the other, really doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Doesn't make a lot of sense. So the Catholic view is the soul of the human person is coterminous with the existence of the person as such. So every soul is created at the time of conception, but you shouldn't think of it like, here's the body, and then God goes bloop and drops in the soul ectoplasm. No, it's like there is a spiritual formality to the human person that is coterminous with, in time and space, the coming into being of the matter that will grow into the human person.
Fascinating. Robert, thank you so much for your email. We're doing a special mailbag edition of our program today here on EWTN Radio, so no calls, please. However, if you would like to send us an email for a future show, we'd love to get it because, you know, the mailbag goes down, the mailbag gets heavy again. So we're ready for yours at ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to come back from one with a great question here from Fernando in the Philippines. Also, one from Bob. Here's one from Mike. Got a lot of great emails to answer on today's mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Glad that you are with us this afternoon. We are not taking your phone calls today because we're doing a special mailbag edition of our program. This one really tickled me. This is from Fernando in the Philippines, and I just love his salutation. He says, "Hello, wise old Dr. David Anders."
Well, he got one part of that appellation correct. David Anders.
David Anders. So he says, "Without devaluing the obligatory character of confession, will the words, quote, 'Lord, I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof, but only say the word and my soul shall be healed,' will these words spoken by a person before the Eucharist with full faith and full belief will indeed become worthy to take the body of Christ and be cleansed of whatever prior state the person was in?" And again, that's from Fernando in the Philippines.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I can enunciate syllables.
Yes.
Right? It's possible for me to enunciate syllables that are effectively meaningless to me and effect no interior change. So I can say the words. I can go through the formulas, either of the act of contrition or the confidior or the prayer before Holy Communion or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And derive no benefit therefrom. In fact, it could even be an occasion of sin for me if I say such words in an attitude of hypocrisy or cynicism or unbelief or bitterness or, you know, hatred of God, whatever it might be. If one forms the interior disposition to will the good, to love God, to be reconciled, to purify oneself of impurity and improper attachments and so forth, So the intention, in other words, is combined with the words, then yeah, then such a prayer can be sufficient. Now, that obviously, if one is in the state of mortal sin and one makes a prayer of perfect contrition, one can be cleansed of sin, but one cannot lawfully partake of Holy Communion.
Mm.
Now, your question is, could one become worthy of Holy Communion? Well, insofar as one's inner disposition is now properly oriented towards God, the answer to the question would be yes. But insofar as one has not yet been formally reconciled to the church, from which one has also been alienated by sin, then from a juridical point of view, no. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, think about, this is a poor analogy, but look, all I can, I'm the young, foolish Dr. Anders, not the old, wise man. I can only come up with poor analogies, okay?
Okay.
Imagine the situation of someone who is accused of a crime, you know, in the civil order, a criminal case or so forth, and he's on trial. And imagine this soul is actually innocent. And so morally, he's good, right? But he's being held in the slammer and cannot actually participate lawfully in civil life. But as soon as the jury renders its verdict of not guilty, well, now his inner disposition, which is one of purity and innocence, is publicly recognized in that public forum, and he is now lawfully capable of getting out there and engaging in that civil relationship.
Okay.
So similarly, a soul could be in mortal sin, could make an act of perfect contrition, be cleansed in their interior life, but they still have to avail themselves of the proper forum, in this case, the internal forum of the confessional, before they can lawfully go back and participate fully in the civil life of the church, which in this state would be the reception of Holy Communion.
All right. Fernando, thanks for listening to us in the Philippines. We're on about 50 radio stations within the Philippines.
That is so cool, I can barely stand it.
Call to Communion here on EWTN. Here's an email from Mike, who is talking about John 4, verses 23 and 24. Mike says, John 4, 23, 24 gives the impression that God somehow is bringing a new era where temples, rites, clergy, etc. will not be so important, but in a few years, humankind is back at it, now influenced by the Roman culture. Is there a possibility that Catholics are still getting this wrong, and can you elaborate?
Absolutely, and absolutely.
Okay.
So can I elaborate? Yes. And can Catholics get it wrong? Of course. Right? Catholics can get literally everything wrong and have done so on many occasions, but not collectively and permanently. Right? So this verse and similar texts underscore a deeply Catholic principle, right? When that is the doctrine of the primacy of the interior life. And as much or more than any other tradition that I know of, the Catholic Church does in fact teach dogmatically sacraments, signs, doctrines, laws, you name it, right? Anything that's external to the soul is secondary to what's interior to the soul, that the interior life is where it's at. And so that passage in Luke 10 where Mary and Martha are running around, well, Martha's running around, Mary's staying put, Martha's attending to the active works of charity, she's feeding everybody, cleaning the dishes, all this kind of thing, and Mary's just sitting there at the foot of Jesus listening, and Martha gets a little bit irritated, and she says, Lord, tell my sister to help with the housework. And he says, Martha, you're worried about a bunch of stuff, but Mary has chosen the better part.
Mm.
Catholic exegesis and commentary has for 2,000 years pointed to that as an allegory for the primacy of the interior life. And that whatever else you may do in Catholic life, you could be preaching, you could be a priest, you could be a layperson, you could be, you know, involved in works of charity or whatever it might be. Whatever you're doing, if it doesn't ultimately serve the end of the interior life, it's wasteful. You're spinning your wheels. You're wasting your time. And Paul teaches us when he says, if I give all I possess to the poor, if I, you know, can, I have miracles, I have the gift of prophecy, I can fathom all knowledge, whatever kind of sort of charismatic gifting I have to serve the church, if it's not accompanied by and leading to charity, which is an inner disposition, then it's worthless. It's worthless. It's worthless, right? So the primacy of the interior life. And this is a doctrine that was taught in the Old Testament. So, you know, the prophets say, you know, the Lord says, what do I need of goats and bulls? I don't take any pleasure in the blood of goats and bulls. What I care about is a contrite heart. Again, the primacy of the interior life. And specifically here in John 4, you have to understand what the context is. Because in Jewish theology, the temple in Jerusalem is not like, you know, first temple of Jerusalem. You know, we got first temple of Selma, Alabama, first temple of, you know, Paris, France. No, yeah. There's only one temple in Judaism, and it is the Jerusalem temple associated specifically with the Davidic dynasty. And the idea was there was only one place on the planet where sacrifice could lawfully be offered, which is why in Judaism today you don't find animal sacrifice. It's not like they abrogated the Levitical law or the Deuteronomic code. What happened is the Romans destroyed the temple. So no temple in Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
no sacrifice, right? And the debate about the proper location of sacrifice, is proper sacrifice to be offered in Jerusalem or someplace else? And of course, the context of John 4 is Jesus' conversation with the Samaritan woman, and the Samaritans offered sacrifice on Mount Gerizim, right? They didn't offer it in Jerusalem. And the debate here is, you Jews say you should offer sacrifice in Jerusalem, but our fathers offer it over here.
Uh-huh.
And Jesus' response is, well, that debate is now moot, right? Because the proper sacrifice is going to be the sacrifice in spirit and in truth, which St. Paul defines for us. He says, offer your bodies as living sacrifice. This is your spiritual act of worship. And the consistent New Testament teaching is that there is a temple of the Lord, and it is your body and the church. So there is still sacrificial worship in Catholicism. There's still sacrificial worship in the world. But the physical temple of stone located in Jerusalem has been replaced by the universal temple of the Catholic faithful. And now that there are still rites was by Christ's institution. He's the one that established the Eucharist. But the Eucharist, again, like everything else in Catholic life, is ultimately ordered towards the interior life. So Pope Pius XII, he writes an encyclical on the Eucharist, Mediator Dei, and he says, look, in the Eucharist, you have two sacrifices. You have the sacrifice of the external rite,
mm-hmm.
but then you also have that internal sacrifice of the Spirit. And guess which one the Pope says is more important?
Mm.
He says the internal sacrifice.
You bet.
Now, I want to throw this out there because, you know, the Second Vatican Council taught that the sacrifice of the Mass, not the Eucharist, the sacrifice of the Mass is the source and summit of our faith. Now, that gets truncated when people quote that passage. They go, oh, the Eucharist is the source and summit. Go read the text. It says the Eucharistic sacrifice is the source and summit, not just the consecrated species, but the whole rite of the Mass is the source and summit. All right, but why is it the source and summit? And a Catholic might say, well, because it contains Christ. True, of course, true, absolutely true. But according to the Pope, containing Christ in the consecrated species is efficacious in us insofar as we conform our interior life to the sacrifice of Christ himself. If we don't make that interior conformity, if we don't offer ourselves in imitation of Jesus, then we can perform the external rite all day long with no benefit to ourselves. And the Catechism, paragraph 2111, actually says that such sacrifices are superstitious. So you can go to Mass superstitiously. That's what the Catechism teaches.
Mm.
If you do not conform your interior life in faith, hope, and charity, in repentance, in reconciliation, you don't bring that disposition to the Mass. You don't do what Jesus is saying here in John 4, worship the Father in spirit and in truth, then even your most rubrically appropriate, devout-looking, smoke-filled, Gregorian chant-saturated Mass becomes a superstition the minute you separate it from the proper disposition of the interior life. That's the teaching of the Catholic Church. That's the dogmatic teaching of the Catholic Church and popes and doctors and councils and fathers.
Mike, thanks so much for your email. We're doing a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion today, so no phone calls, please. Got to this one here from Emma, and it made me smile because seems like every day I'm learning a new word, and a lot of these new words come from our listeners. We got some really sharp listeners out there.
Cool.
So here it is. Emma says, do Protestants believe in the incantatory nature of grace? And could this be the reason they don't believe in sacraments the way Catholics do? Thanks, Emma. Incantatory.
If by incantatory, do you think that she means like by way of incantation?
That'd be my guess.
Yeah, so let me do this, all right? Since I'm not exactly sure where we're going with this question, let me just talk about the Catholic doctrine of grace and the Protestant doctrine of grace.
Okay.
With the caveat that every time I ever generalize about Protestants, I get angry letters from some Protestants saying, I don't think that, right? So I grant you that, and I'll just emphasize, when I generalize about Protestants, I am talking about the mainstream confessional Protestant traditions, like the Reformed tradition, like the Lutheran tradition, like the Anglican 39 articles, recognizing that there are always exceptions.
Sure.
Okay. And if
sure.
you're an exception, please have mercy on me.
Okay.
So by and large, the Protestant view of grace is that grace is God's unmerited favor. That's what grace means. Grace means God's determination to treat me as some particular financial radio host likes to say, better than I deserve. Okay? That's what grace means.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
And while that determination to treat me better than I deserve might also include a decision to morally transform me, and hence the Protestant doctrine of regeneration is a real part of the Protestant tradition, grace as such is primarily in God. It's God's attitude or disposition towards me that's being indicated when I speak. God is gracious, means he's kind, he's forgiving, he's loving, he treats me better than I deserve, etc. In the Catholic doctrine of grace, it includes all of that. It includes the idea that God is positively disposed towards me, but grace is also the change. Insofar as, you know, St. Paul says, I worked harder than all of the other apostles, but not me, yet God's grace within me, that grace can also refer to an inner quality, not just something imputed to me by God, not just something credited to my account on God's behalf, but something that actually inheres within me, right, as constitutive of my way of being in the world. That grace is an inner quality that transforms my orientation, my consciousness, my ethical realities. And it's something that I can consciously participate in and deepen through my cooperation and effort. And so that's the fundamental difference between the Protestant doctrine of grace and the Catholic doctrine of grace. Now, I'm not sure what you mean by incantatory, except if you mean like that it can be invoked by way of incantation.
Hmm.
And to me, incantation smacks of magic.
Yeah.
And the Catholic Church definitely seeks to distinguish its spirituality from anything magical. To me, magic means that, like by the mere performance of some sort of signifying rite, that one automatically achieves the desired effect in a way that can kind of manipulate nature, you know, to my own advantage or according to my own whim. And the Catholic Church doesn't view that grace that way. It thinks that while we have been given objective and definite rites that have a specific formula to them, that my appropriation of those benefits requires the proper disposition within my will. Mm-hmm. So that would be, you know, I think somewhat different from what I would think of as incantatory.
Mm-hmm.
You may have something else in mind. Do Protestants believe that grace is incantatory? Depends on the Protestant, right? So in the Reformed tradition, grace is something over which humans have no control, according to Calvin and his ilk. It's something that comes uninvited, unanticipated, and irresistibly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Emma, hopefully that is helpful for you regarding the use of the word incantatory. If not, you're certainly welcome to write us again. Here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Thanks so much for your question today. In a moment, we'll get to emails from Emily, also Gerald and Joey and Nick in Illinois, Bob, and probably a few more here before we close up shop on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion on EWTN. Do stay with us. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. We're not taking your calls today. We're doing a special mailbag edition of our program. And again, if you would like to send us an email, we're always ready for it at ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. I think you'll get a kick out of this one from Emily, David. She says, I was formerly a Southern Baptist. I became Catholic 10 years ago. I watch TV quite a bit as a 70-year-old infirm woman. I watch a lot of EWTN, but I often see Protestants on commercials. And there is always the sinner's prayer repeated. It's familiar and yet comfortable. Am I endangering my Catholic faith by reciting it with them? I never call or go further, but it seems to fit in the Catholic faith. Thanks, Emily.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, might be interesting to have a little history of the sinner's prayer.
Yes.
You know, I grew up in the evangelical tradition myself, and so, you know, I grew up with this idea that the sinner's prayer was absolutely essential to Christian initiation. You want to become a Christian, you pray the sinner's prayer. You want somebody else to become a Christian, you share the sinner's prayer. And you may be familiar with the little yellow booklet from what used to be called Campus Crusade for Christ. Now they call it CRU, called The Four Spiritual Laws, written by Bill Bright.
Mm.
And it's probably one of the best-known presentations of a version of the sinner's prayer. If memory serves me correct, I think that booklet has been distributed more than a billion times across
really?
The planet, making it probably one of the most widely printed pieces of literature in the history of the world, really. I mean, it's just amazingly extended across the globe. So I grew up, my parents used to carry the Four Spiritual Laws around in their back pockets and purses and would hand them out at gas stations and grocery stores and, you know, to bank tellers and you name it. And that was just, man, that was the thing. You want somebody to get to Jesus, you give them Four Spiritual Laws, lead them in the sinner's prayer, and you've done the deed, right? And it was a shock to me when I got to college, and I had read the Bible as a kid, you know, of course, but in bits and pieces and memorized it in Bible school. But as a college student, I said, I'm going to like start more systematically going through this thing. And I started systematically reading through the New Testament. You know what I didn't find?
What's that?
I didn't find the sinner's prayer. and I was like, well, that's weird, you know. And I really went to work on it, it's got to be in there. It's got to be in there, you know. I couldn't find it. And so I go back to the Four Spiritual Laws because that was like the Bible 2.0, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I started going through it, and I was like, well, how do they get this? Okay, well, he pulls this verse from this context, and he pulls that verse from that context, and this verse from that, lines them all up, and oh, now you have it. But it's not like that anywhere in the Bible itself. Huh, wonder why that is. You know, I started puzzling about that. And of course, I went on to get degrees in theology. I went to seminary. Majored in church history and theology, went on and got a PhD in the history of theology. And my focus was on the history of Protestant theology, especially the Calvinist tradition. And I was like, I got to figure out where this thing came from. So it wasn't all I worked on, but I mean, I put a lot of work into trying to figure out how did Protestants arrive at this idea of the sinner's prayer. And what I discovered was that early Calvinists believed that if you receive God's grace, you could never lose it. You could never lose it. You were guaranteed salvation. That God's grace was often communicated through the sacraments, but not always. And the sacraments didn't always communicate grace.
Mm.
So a person could be baptized and receive grace, according to the Calvinists, or they could be baptized and not receive grace. But if they did get grace, then they'd never fall away. And so it kind of became an important question in Calvinism. How do I know I'm one of the people who's received grace?
Yeah.
Right? And the Puritans had all kinds of tests for that. They argued with each other about it. But basically, you know, one of the Puritan ideas was that if you've got grace, then your life should show it, you know, that your moral behavior will change. So you could infer grace from your moral behavior. But then there were other Protestants who said, well, doesn't that seem to throw you back on all the problems of Catholicism and you know, the whole tormented conscience thing, you know, if you're constantly scrutinizing your behavior for evidence of grace, isn't that just like tantamount to living in constant, you know, moral anxiety like Luther said he did when he was a Catholic? So it can't be that. It's just got to be kind of a sure fiat that God just declares and just by, you know, some sort of intuition of grace, you know. So they had all these debates about each other. But eventually, in the 18th century, there was another point of view that came up, and it was this. It was like, hey, here's how you know you have grace. You have a conversion experience. You have a conversion experience. It's not so much the ongoing work of regeneration like the Puritans held, but like you're conscious of this passage from darkness to light, you know, and it comes across you, you know, like a lightning bolt. And Jonathan Edwards wrote a magnificent little treatise about on the, what is it, the surprising work of the Spirit of God or something like that was a really magnificent statement of that point of view and quite compelling. I mean, I've read it and I thought, ooh, that's pretty good rhetoric there. You know? And but the person who instrumentalized that more than anybody else was George Whitefield. And he was kind of the Billy Graham of the 18th century, preached to millions of people, or at least tens of thousands of people. And he preached conversion. He preached the new birth. He didn't have a sinner's prayer, but he did try to preach the gospel to people in a way that would evoke this conversion, this moral transformation. But he still thought it was a sovereign work of God and that you couldn't manufacture it. You know, like it would just sort of come upon you and then you'd know. Well, what happened about 100 years later, Charles Finney, who was another revivalist, but with a different theology of grace, said, well, good job, Whitefield. You converted a lot of people, but you're wrong about one thing. You can manufacture it. You can absolutely psychologically manipulate people into giving themselves to God. And he was not a Calvinist, so he did not believe in predestination.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he invented a lot of techniques. One that he called the anxious bench. You'd get people to sit up in the front of the church, you'd yell in their face and exhort them until they kind of got overwhelmed. Another one, and that one kind of faded out for obvious reasons, but another one that has stuck around was the altar call.
Oh, yes.
You know, call people to the front of church, get them out of their seats, make them do something that makes them feel engaged, and you can kind of manipulate them into making a choice for Jesus, all right? And that became part of the Protestant tradition in the 19th century because of Finney, but you see how it's an evolution from, you know, 400 years of theology.
Yeah.
And it really became an institution. Well, early 20th century, late 19th, D.L. Moody, another great revivalist evangelist in the Protestant evangelical fundamentalist wing, was doing this all over the place, and he would have these huge campaigns with, you know, tens of thousands of people. And, you know, they're exhorting all kinds of folks, but he added another dimension, which is that when you call people up, you get them into little groups, and then you assign like a helper to lead a small group and exhort, you know, individuals. He can't do that 10,000 people, but he can have associates. And he wanted to give them a way to make sure they had sealed the deal. And so D.L. Moody wrote the first version of what would become the Sinner's Prayer. And because it seemed to work, like they were able to manufacture and manipulate all of these conversions, right? It was like, hey, you know, why beat something that works? And hence, the Sinner's Prayer entered into the Protestant lexicon of worship and evangelization and became so second nature that it started to be taken for granted by people like the young me or like my parents. But it really is an evolution, right? And I don't think that the psychology or the theology of the thing corresponds to the spirit of the New Testament, and certainly doesn't correspond even to the historic Protestantism, let alone historic Catholicism. And if one conceives of the Sinner's Prayer as this kind of definitive engagement with God that guarantees one eternal life and assures one of forgiveness of sins, sort of, you know, without qualification, then I would say you're taking it in the wrong sense. You're taking it maybe in the sense it was intended, which is a Protestant revivalistic way and not the way of the Catholic Church. If, however, you take the words of the prayer in a Catholic sense,
uh-huh.
And look, Catholics believe, let's take, for example, the Catholic practice of spiritual communion. If you've ever listened to the Mass at EWTN, there's a woman with a beautiful British accent.
Sister Grace.
There you go, who prays a prayer for spiritual communion that I can't quote it. Prompt probably has the thing memorized, but it's pretty darn close to, Jesus, come now into my soul and dwell within me interiorly, right?
Yeah.
If you take the Sinner's Prayer in that kind of way, the idea, Catholics believe in the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. We think it's something that can be deepened and can be lost, right? But can also be renewed, and you invite the Lord's presence into your life in that kind of way, which is an ongoing relationship with God that doesn't guarantee your salvation, but does assure you intimacy with Him in the present moment, then I would say it's perfectly fine to pray. But you got to have your understanding of redemption, your understanding of salvation,
sure,
right,
sure,
to be sure that you're taking it in a Catholic way and not the way D.L. Moody took it.
Emily, thank you so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. You know, EWTN's religious catalog is your online destination for gifts and what Mother Angelica called holy reminders, including apparel, books, devotionals, jewelry, mugs, so much more. Buy Catholic, shop EWTNRC.com today. By the way, you can receive regular emails from Religious Catalog. Just visit EWTN.com and click on the word subscribe.
Here's that act of spiritual communion.
Oh, okay.
Because I just found it. It's beautiful. I need to memorize this.
Okay.
My Jesus, I believe that you are present in the most holy sacrament. I love you above all things, and I desire to receive you into my soul. Since I cannot at this moment receive you sacramentally, come at least spiritually into my heart. I embrace you as if you were already there and unite myself wholly to you. Never permit me to be separated from you. Amen.
It's beautiful.
I can find no fault with that whatsoever at all.
Yeah.
So if you feel this urge to pray some kind of deepening commitment to Christ, to invite him into your life, go look up the act of spiritual communion on the EWTN website. Learn that one. I need to memorize that. Pray that one. That's good stuff.
You better believe it. Call to communion here on EWTN. Interesting question here from Jerry in Independence. Jerry says, when I see protesters holding signs like "My Body, My Choice," or hear discussions related to transgenderism, do we really own our own bodies, or are our bodies on loan from God? And what does the church teach us, or what does the Bible state on how to treat our bodies? Thanks, Jerry in Independence.
Yeah, I appreciate that question a lot. Okay, so this is a big difference between the Catholic view of the moral life and what I would think to be kind of the, you know, sort of the modern secular view of the moral life. As I understand it, the modern secular view of the moral life is that nothing is higher, nothing is more primary than my own autonomy. Right, that my right to self-determination is absolute, and nothing constrains it. Not reason, not nature, not my body, not your body. That I have an absolute moral right to define my life, your life, reality, my body, my lack of bodily integrity, you name it. That I can define it any way I want. As long as I don't do, and here's the kind of the key term here, as long as I don't hurt anybody else. But there's a very anemic understanding of what it means to hurt someone else, right? So in their view, hurting, quote unquote, hurting someone else means basically violating their autonomy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But two people who, say, for example, would mutually agree to harm one another in any other way, well, they'd say that's just fine. If that's what you're into, bud, if you want to go cut off each other's toes or something, you know, if you want to do it, you know, no harm, no foul, as long as everybody consents.
Wow. Right?
Consent is like the moral magic of the modern secular world. As long as people consent, then no harm done, right? That is not the Catholic view of morality. So the Catholic Church would agree you can't run around harming people. But we have a much more robust idea of what it means to harm someone. Harming someone is more than just violating their own liberty or autonomy. And we don't think you should do that. We don't think you should compel people against their will. But we also recognize that humans have a tremendous capacity for self-deception and self-destructive behavior. And sometimes they're very deeply attached to that self-destructive and self-deceptive behavior. And just simply to plead autonomy and liberty doesn't suddenly make those behaviors benevolent. And that sometimes the most charitable thing I can help a person do is to actually gain more interior freedom by liberating them from a narrow and self-defeating, self-destructive point of view. So let me give you an example. Like, let's say I conceive the insane theory that my body doesn't actually exist. There are people who think that,
yeah.
Right? That I'm just a brain in a vat someplace. And that, you know, or like doctors do no benefit. And so I can just will myself well. All right. Something like that. Well, yeah, I mean, this celebrated 19th century American religious figure who took that point of view that
yes.
Death was an illusion and illness was an illusion. You know what happened to her? She died.
She died.
Right. Okay. And people who have followed her in that belief have died. Have resisted medical care. You know, illness is an illusion. I don't need that. And then the next thing you know, they're, you know, dead at, you know, age 45 at the beginning of a promising career in like puppetry or something. That's a shame. That's a terrible shame. And so the Catholic's position would be like, it's actually more charitable to try to persuade the person, look, I don't want to violate your integrity or your autonomy, but I would like to disabuse you of the notion that your body doesn't exist. Because you'll flourish more. You'll have a more robust and benevolent and productive life and greater flourishing if you can be liberated from the illusion that your body doesn't exist. And so Catholics think that morality is actually the obligation to seek happiness for ourselves and other people, but in the most robust way possible that takes full account of nature, including our own reason. And it entails the obligation to overcome the kind of self-deceptive and self-destructive practices that wreak havoc on our lives and others. And so it's more than mere consent. And that includes my moral obligation to my own body. You know, if I have a neurotic compulsion to self-harm, which many people do, right? The Catholic Church says to talk about that as a right, like I have a right to my own neurotic, compulsive self-harm, is really to render the idea of right almost meaningless. Because if rights don't proceed from some sort of rational conception of human nature, you know, as intrinsically good, then what grounds this assertion that I have an absolute moral right to my own conscience and autonomy? Nothing. That's just a bare assertion floating in the air. Mm-hmm. You've got to ground that in some kind of notion of the integrity of the human person, which is to say to get back into the question of nature and back into the question of reason. So my autonomy doesn't liberate me from my own nature or from my own reason, and the obligation to seek happiness for myself and the greatest number means taking full account of reason and nature. And so, you know, if somebody presents me to an ideology and says, you know what, my body is immaterial to my identity and there's only my self-declared gender, say, for example, it is the real me. Well, there's no philosophical defense of that position that can hold water. And so I'm not obligated to believe that. Yeah. In fact, I'm obligated not to believe that because it runs flat contrary to reason.
Jerry, thanks so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Here's one from Joey now. Dr. Anders, I was having a discussion with a very open-minded Protestant. He said he can't see veneration of Mary being biblical. I then explained that the earliest prayers to Mary were from the second century and that the early church fathers revered Mary. His response was, yeah, and others didn't. How do I respond to that? It may just be me, but it kind of sounded like he was almost saying that Marian veneration could be antiquarianism. How do we know that it's not? But more importantly, how do I defend veneration of Mary against his remarks? Thanks, Joey.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So let's start with the premise of his objection, which is that Marian devotion isn't biblical. Well, I think it is biblical. But let's assume for the sake of argument that it isn't biblical. So? So? You know what else isn't biblical? Here's something that isn't biblical. The idea that all devotional practices should be tested against the express words of Scripture. That's not biblical. Nothing in Scripture says that. So he is asserting a premise, a principle here, you have to test everything against the very words of the Bible, that the Bible itself does not teach. So it fails its own test. So he's asserting the Protestant doctrine of sola scriptura, test everything by the Bible. But the Bible doesn't teach the principle of sola scriptura. The Bible actually teaches a very different principle, which is the authority of the church. That's the Bible points towards the authority of the church. When Jesus founded the church, he said, I'm founding this church, and I give to it the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever St. Peter binds on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever he looses on earth will be loosed in heaven. And all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, you go for it and teach the nations everything I've commanded you. I'll be with you to the end of the age, right? And whoever hears you hears me. That is very different from sola scriptura.
Yeah.
And so as a Catholic, as someone who actually wants to follow the teaching of Jesus in this matter, if the church tells me to venerate Mary and I don't have any support for that doctrine other than the teaching of the church, I'm already 10,000 times better off in my sort of rational integrity in terms of the coherence of my faith than someone that just points to the Bible alone. Because I'm actually directing my interior life towards the authority that Christ established, namely the teaching church, rather than, you know, what has sometimes been called the paper pope of the Protestant tradition. Right? So that's number one. So what if it isn't biblical? That's not my criteria of authentic Christianity. However, it is biblical. It is biblical. The Blessed Virgin Mary herself, in the Gospel of St. Luke, prophesied, all generations will call me blessed.
Yep.
And the angel venerated her, Gabriel, when he said, Hail, full of grace. Well, that's the Hail Mary right there.
Yeah.
Right? Hail Mary, full of grace. Blessed art thou among women. It's biblical.
Yeah.
It's as biblical as it gets all day long. All right? Second century fathers venerated the Blessed Virgin. Well, I think first century fathers venerated the Blessed Virgin. Okay? But second century fathers venerated the Blessed Virgin, and some didn't. Okay? Well, he didn't say some fathers. Some people didn't.
Correct.
Okay? You know what else some people did in the second century? Some people in the second century thought that there were two gods. God of the Old Testament, God of the New. One bad, one good. One material, one spiritual. And that Jesus was the cosmic alien come from outer space to liberate you from the Matrix. It was called Gnosticism.
Wow.
That was a big going concern in the second century. Have at it. Be my guest. You know, I mean, like, sure. Yeah. There have been dissenters from Christian orthodoxy even within the New Testament. You know, St. John says there are people who went out from us. They weren't one of them. They weren't with us, or they would have stayed with us. Mm. You know, don't hold with those guys. You know, St. Paul says, if someone preaches to you a gospel other than the one you've received, let him be anathema. So clearly there were people preaching a gospel other than the one they'd received. Okay, so what's your point? St. Paul also says there have to be schisms among you so that those of you that are right in doctrine can be established, right? If you don't have error, you don't have something against which to judge truth. Yeah, that's fine. Okay, so there, not everybody venerated the Blessed Virgin Mary. Great. And what's your point? I want to be with the ones that did, because they were the Orthodox. They were the Catholics. They were the ones that were within the church.
Sure.
And that was the third part of the question. What was that?
How do we know it's not, more importantly, how do I defend veneration of Mary against these remarks?
Yeah, right. Okay. So I think I've done that. He also asked a question, how do I know it isn't just antiquarianism?
Right, right.
Right. Because we're still doing it. Like, uh-huh. Antiquarianism means that I hearken back to some classical golden age as the rule, right? And the fact of the matter is that Marian veneration is universal and Catholic within the church. I mean, you find it everywhere. You find it always. You find it by all. I mean, it sort of meets the definition of a Catholic doctrine, and it's still very much part of the tradition and always has been. It's not something we recovered. It's not something we simply dig out of antiquity randomly. It's been central. Veneration of saints and of the Blessed Virgin Mary has been central to the Catholic moral imagination and life of prayer and liturgy from the beginning. So that's not antiquarianism.
There you go. Joey, thanks so much for your email. We'll probably close with this one from Bob, who listens to us on Spirit Radio 88.3. He says, is it plausible to think that when 12-year-old Jesus was found in the temple teaching and asking questions, that some of the Pharisees and scribes could be the same ones that put him to death some 21 years later?
Yeah, that's plausible. And some of them also could have been among the ones that joined the church. We learn from the book of Acts that many people from the Pharisaical party became believers in Jesus.
Okay. Well, there you go. Bob, thanks so much for your email. Quick one here from Nick in Illinois regarding transubstantiation. He says, God is always true to his word and clearly stated that the bread and wine is his body and blood at the time of the Last Supper. Following, he states, do this in memory of me. The church in tradition has taught that the same reality happens every time the words are spoken at Mass during the Eucharistic prayer. To me, the words do this in memory of me do not provide an explicit truth that the same reality happens when subsequent rituals are performed. I suppose reading some of the early church fathers could fill in the gap on how the church came to that dogmatic conclusion. Do you have any insight into this?
Yeah, thanks. So your question, the premise of your question seems to presume that exegesis is kind of the principal concern in establishing Christian doctrine. And you quibble, you're worried, you're maybe anxious about the fact that the exegesis of the words of institutions is ambiguous. But I would suggest to you that all written texts are ambiguous in this way, right? And I think, you know, the history of modern hermeneutics only further underscores that fact, that texts are ambiguous. And what a text means always has to be understood in light of, well, in which community? And the applying that in the Catholic context, there is a consistent history of interpretation of that text within the community that we call the Catholic Church from antiquity to the present. And so the meaning of the text is made evident in the community that wrote the text, received the text, and continues to celebrate the text, namely the Catholic Church.
There it is. Nick in Illinois, thanks so much for your email. Always a lot of fun to do these mailbag programs. Dr. David Andrews, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
We do this program Monday through Friday live, normally, except on days like this, here on EWTN at 2 p.m. Eastern. Do check out the podcast by going to EWTN.com, click on radio, and then look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our producer, Pedro Quiles, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Andrews. Thanks for joining us. See you next time right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a great day and God bless.